Welcome back. You're listening to White Christmas, the story of the Jews who created Tin Pan Alley and Hollywood, Part 1. I'm Larry Josephson. Jewish popular songwriters were influenced by the synagogue music they grew up with. But they also lived in the modern world and absorbed the sounds and music around them. Harold Arlen grew up in the synagogue where his father was a renowned cantor.
Arlen had everything to do with what was in front of him, the largely black stroke swing culture of dance bands, and he wanted to join the contemporary.
John Lahr is senior drama critic for The New Yorker.
How come you do me like you do, do, do? How come you do me like you do? Why do you try to make me feel so blue? I ain't done nothing to you.
Arlen grew up in Buffalo, New York. He left for New York City at age 16 to become a singer.
He was in a group called the Buffalodians, and Bing Crosby saw him and said that, you know, if he hadn't have become a composer, he would have been a successful star singer.
Pardon me, pretty baby.
Because he was very idiosyncratic, and many people who heard him who didn't know him thought he was black because he really swung the music. He played in his voice, he played the black chord, so to speak. He really angled the music in an unusual way.
Was it summer when I met you? Was it underneath the moon? Was it London? Were we golfing? How could you forget so soon?
As a singer, he was hired in 1929 to be in a Broadway show. And the actual arranger, Fletcher Henderson, was ill, so Arlen stepped in just to be the rehearsal pianist. And he was just fiddling around at the piano, as he always did. And Harry Warren liked it and said, I'll get you a songwriter. And he got him a Ted Kohler, and it became Get Happy, which was only the fourth song he'd ever written in his life.
Get your troubles and just get happy. You better chase all your cares away. Sing hallelujah, come on, get happy. Get ready for the judgment day.
The sun is shining, come on, get happy. The Lord is waiting to take your hand. Shout hallelujah, come on, get happy. We're going to the promised land.
Because of his particular love of African-American sound, he and Kohler found themselves happily writing for the Cotton Club, which had the really great talent pool of American music makers.
We should explain that the Cotton Club was in Harlem, and it was a place that whites went to during the 30s to hear all these great black artists, and that black folk weren't admitted to.
Well, not only that, although there were black entertainers on the stage, the choruses were very, very light-skinned. It was a very curious racial exchange going on. His songs were sung by Ethel Waters, Lena Horne, Cab Calloway. Duke Ellington played them, Cab Calloway's band. So he was suddenly absorbed into a wonderful and exciting musical community. He was influenced by them, but he gave to that community songs like Stormy Weather, which got 12 curtain calls the first time it was played in Harlem.
Don't know why there's no sun up in the sky. Stormy weather since my man and I ain't together.
Ethel Waters loved Arlen and said he was the, quote, Negroest white man she'd ever met.
Was this affinity to black music based on the music itself or based on a real sympathy for the conditions of black America?
Oh, I think the former. I think it was all the elements of joy and the heartbrokenness and the happiness that are merged together. The way song functions as a survival and a vehicle for the culture's history, I think that they absolutely understood that. This music was internalized and became a kind of internal architecture for the entire culture.
You got to accentuate the positive.
It transformed their feelings of longing and loss, which were Jewish in their origin, in a kind of universal idiom that the entire culture absorbs and comes to accept. Those anti-Semites might have not accepted this had it been Jewish. Really what they were trying to convince America of was the prosperity and well-being and the goodness of the culture.
You got to spread joy
up to the maximum.
Bring gloom
down
to the minimum.
Then
Otherwise, liable to walk upon the sea.
As Jewish songwriters graduated from Tin Pan Alley to Broadway and then moved west to Hollywood, they moved away from their Jewishness. They took American names and tried to emulate Gentile culture. John Lahr is the son of Bert Lahr, the vaudeville comedian who played the Cowardly Lion in The Wizard of Oz.
What makes a king out of a slave? Courage. What makes the flag on the mast to wave? Courage.
I want to just tell you a story about my father. I was not raised Jewish. I was raised Catholic. From my father's point of view, that was just fine. Sometime in the middle of my teenagehood, I discovered that his name was not Lahr, but Larheim, which was a great shock to me. And the way I coped with it was to joke about it with my friends who called me Larheim in private. Cut to I'm an adult. I'm living in, as I do, in London. And my mother is there with me and some of my friends sitting around at a tea table. And one of them refers to me as Larheim. And afterwards, my mother, who was a Ziegfeld girl, rather grand in her old age, took me aside and said, John, I really don't know why you let your friends call you Larheim. And I said, well, Mom, I mean, Dad was only one of the greatest, most famous Jewish comedians of the first half of the 20th century. And my mother sort of did a lot of neck acting, and she sort of touched her throat. And she said, John, your father was not Jewish. He was a star.
If I were king of the forest, not queen, not duke, not prince.
In the 1930s, Hollywood began to import composers, writers, and performers wholesale. Harold Arlen, along with Irving Berlin and George Gershwin, wrote songs for Hollywood movies.
The reason in the terms of the American musical that these guys emigrated to the West Coast is really simple. The Depression more than halved the number of musicals on Broadway. They were all about work. And all those great songwriters were arguing among themselves, should we go out? Should we stay out? For them, leaping to Hollywood was like Liza leaping from ice floe to ice floe. They landed happily there. Certainly, Arlen did. He loved it. He loved the climate.
When the sun comes out and that rain stops beating on my window pane.
He kept a great record of his life there and the ease of it. He took home movies. They're really wonderful primary evidence of the life there. There he is, Arlen, serving canapes to the Gershwins and Moss Hart, playing tennis with Harburg. Here comes Al Jolson down the driveway in the middle of the summer in a camel's hair coat. I mean, there they are diving into the swimming pool, and there's Yip wearing his hula skirt and a dog pulling his skirt off. He was extremely happy in that luxury.
I'm going Hollywood.
You know, Hollywood was a mecca for talented, ambitious Americans who wanted to make it in popular culture. Where else were they going to go?
Jay Hoberman is senior film critic for The Village Voice. He co-wrote the book Entertaining America about Jews in the entertainment industry.
I'm on my way. Here's my beret. I'm going Hollywood.
The first people in motion pictures were not Jewish. Thomas Edison invented the movie camera and projector. In 1915, D.W. Griffith made the first hugely successful film, Birth of a Nation. The industry really took off in the hands of half a dozen ambitious Jewish immigrants who have come to be known as the moguls. Their stories are similar. They arrived poor and settled in New York City. These poorly educated immigrants saw business opportunities where others didn't. First in Nickelodeons. Eventually, they created a new, uniquely American industry and art form, the movies. Samuel Goldwyn was born Shmuel Geldfish in Warsaw. Like most of the moguls, he left the shtetls of Eastern Europe in search of the American dream. In 1899, he started work in a glove factory in upstate New York. Eventually, he became a salesman for the company.
And from there, he was quickly elevated to become the head salesman. And the next thing you know, this young man, now in his 20s, still barely could speak English, was living in New York City, earning $10,000 a year, living in a wonderful apartment and going to work every day in a beautiful office.
A. Scott Berg, Sam Goldwyn's biographer.
One day in the summer of 1913, he walked through Times Square, and it was a hot August day. And he just couldn't take the walk anymore, and for the first time in his life, he stepped inside a theater. And he looked up on the screen. He saw a character named Bronco Billy making a very daring leap from a galloping horse onto a moving train. Well, this was the most exciting thing Samuel Goldfish had ever seen. And it was in that moment he decided he wanted to get into the motion picture business. By the time Samuel Goldfish got home, smitten with this new idea, the first person he mentioned it to was his brother-in-law, Jesse Lasky. Let's go into the movie business. Let's form a company together, and we'll name it the Jesse L. Lasky Company. They found a hit play on Broadway called The Squaw Man, and Goldfish thought this was a wonderful idea for a film because it was a Western and a love story. So he got hold of the rights, and Goldfish got in touch with the agent of a man he thought could write and direct the screenplay, William DeMille. They went to the agent, who was William DeMille's mother. She said, "Oh, well, listen, that sounds wonderful, but unfortunately, William is very busy right now. But I do have another boy named Cecil. Maybe Cecil could do it. Has he ever directed before?" No, but Cecil had acted a lot, and he had done a little writing. And the next thing you know, Cecil got himself the job. And Sam Goldfish put Jesse Lasky and Cecil DeMille and a small cast and a cameraman on a train in New York City and sent them to go out west to film in Flagstaff, Arizona. And a few days later, a telegram was sent back from Jesse Lasky saying, "Flagstaff, no good for our purposes. Have rented a barn in a place called Hollywood." And there, the Jesse L. Lasky Feature Play Company filmed the first feature film ever made in a place called Hollywood.
Out where they say, let us be gay, I'm going Hollywood. I'll ballyhoo things to you, I'm going Hollywood.
In New York, two of the most successful of these guys were Adolph Zukor and William Fox, both of whom actually had made their money in the clothing industry, but then invested in chains of Nickelodeons on the Lower East Side and in other New York neighborhoods. Fox later went on to create the studio, which we now know as 20th Century Fox, and Zukor founded the studio that eventually became Paramount.
My name is Adolph Zukor. When I came to this country, it was in 1888. I was not quite 16 years. I obtained employment in the upholstery factory for $2 a week. I started in business in Chicago in 92, took out contract work for the novelty things that we made, these neck scarves, mink scarves, you know, with the head on the end, and that ladies just put around their neck. And that's the way I started in business, and that lasted up to 1900.
Adolph Zukor, from a 1958 oral history.
When I was writing my biography of Goldwyn, I put together a list of all the major moguls who got Hollywood started. They all came from within 500 miles of each other in Eastern Europe. All came to America within 5 years of each other. all moved to New York and went into businesses largely in and around the garment business. And they all made the leap at the same time to get into the movie business. And it makes perfect sense because these were all young men in a hurry who wanted something more. It's the reason they left the old country. And here was a brand new industry. This was Silicon Valley. This was the big bubble, and you could invest very little and perhaps have huge results. And it was also, because of its newness, one of the few businesses in which Jews could not only enter, but they could own. They could become overnight entrepreneurs.
At the end of 1903, we gave up the fur business and went into the penny arcade.
Adolf Zucker.
Just about the time we heard about motion pictures. It wasn't very well known, nothing in New York, but I heard that there was a Nickelodeon open in Pittsburgh. So I took a trip to Pittsburgh and looked at that Nickelodeon. The Nickelodeon was inside of a great big billiard parlor. And they showed pictures for a nickel. So people went in, they saw, laughed, enjoyed it. And when I saw this in Pittsburgh, I was very much fascinated by it. Then I decided that would be much better than Penny Arcade and there was a greater future in it. Then I took and rented a building next door to the Penny Arcade, which I intended to fix up for a moving picture theater, Nickelodeon. And that's the way the picture business developed.
In New York, in the years just after World War I, you would have found Jews heavily represented in all aspects of the movie industry. I mean, probably there would hardly be a Jewish family in New York who didn't have some relative who wasn't, you know, taking tickets or playing the violin somewhere in a Nickelodeon or working as an editor or a projectionist. When movies began, they were a very déclassé form of entertainment.
There was no way these Jews right off the boat could become overnight successes or maybe even lifelong successes in the banking business, for example, or in the steel business. But here, because it was a new industry, one especially in which Gentiles had second thoughts about. Actors and actresses were really just sort of one step away from being prostitutes in the eyes of many.
It was in some ways beneath the level of public awareness. The so-called Nickelodeon craze of 1905 to 1910 was going on for several years before it was even ever noticed or written about in a middle-class journals or magazines.
I think there was an even deeper reason why the motion picture business appealed so much to these Jewish immigrants. And you must remember, of course, that these original films were all silent films. And that is, they told stories. And they did tell them, to use the great cliché, in the universal language. These immigrants could barely speak English themselves, and here was an artistic medium in which you did not need a great command of the English language.
This was this Chase Pictures comedy, you know. A man would be on a stepladder washing the window, somebody passed by, kicked the ladder, water on the head of the man, and then the man from the ladder came down and chased the man who kicked the ladder, then the police chased him, and that was the end of the story.
By the late teens and into the early 20s, there were still hundreds of small movie studios, each started by men like Adolf Zucker, Louis B. Mayer, the boys named Warner, Harry Cohen. Over the next few years, only the fittest survived. Some got swallowed up, some disappeared, some merged, and indeed, Samuel Goldfish, as he was still named, was kicked out of his second company, one he had formed with two brothers named Selwyn, and they formed the Goldwyn Company. It was either Goldwyn or Selfish. They settled on Goldwyn. The Selwyn brothers immediately realized they couldn't be partners with Sam Goldfish, and they kicked him out. Goldfish then petitioned to change his name to Sam Goldwyn. Meantime, the Goldwyn Company merged with the Metro Company, which was run by Louis B. Mayer, and that formed Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer.
Universal Pictures was founded by Carl Laemmle. Louis J. Selznick ran Universal for Laemmle for about 5 years. In this 1958 oral history, his son, David O. Selznick, tells how his father got the job.
The story, as I've always heard it, was that he had talked himself into a job with Carl Laemmle. This was, I should think, around 1912 or 13. And Universal was in the midst of a political battle among its various owners. My father had moved into an office and sent a note to each of the three factions that Louis J. Selznick had been appointed general manager, and each one assumed that the other factions had done it because he had appointed himself. And he ran it as general manager for some time till he decided to form his own company. Hollywood was a village, really. Everyone there knew everyone else. There was an intense spirit of competition. Everybody knew precisely what everybody else was doing. They were the great pioneering days, the great frontier days. Everything was a first. When sound came in, everything became new all over again. The first Western with sound, the first war picture with sound. Everything we did had never been done before.
It was more colorful. It was just like a new discovery. People flocked to. And a number of pictures were made, because the more they made, the more the appetite grew with the facilities and the numbers of the pictures made. So there were never too many pictures at that time. Everybody could do something. Everybody got an opportunity.
Every girl, a handsome looker, had a dance with Mr. Zucker. Mr. Thomas in stepped around just like a prince. William Fox and Jesse Lassie both joined in the fun. Big directors mingled with the actors. Why, the whole bunch seemed like one. Dancing at that moving picture ball.
All these Jewish moguls deeply, truly believed in the American dream. And the amazing thing is that they found a business in which they could literally manufacture the American dream. And they so loved this country, and they so loved all the riches that were thrust upon them, that they believed in their heart of hearts the way to keep it going was to keep promoting the American dream itself.
Being outsiders, they could see what was American in a way, perhaps, that people native to the culture couldn't see it. And certainly, they embraced those values. And, you know, an extreme example would be Louis B. Mayer's great love for the Andy Hardy series.
How do you do?
Good morning. Won't you come in?
My mother just sent these over to your grandmother.
You're Andy Hardy, aren't you?
Uh-huh. I live right next door.
You have this kid growing up in a kind of idealized American town, and his father is this infinitely wise WASP patriarch, and an apple pie mom, and just a delightful childhood with white picket fences. And, you know, nobody lived that way. It wasn't real, but for Mayer, this was the truest expression of what America could be.
These films were not made cynically. Louis B. Mayer believed if your mother was sick, if you got down on your knees and prayed, she was going to be okay by the last reel, and that the dog would come running in and wag his tail and lick you on the face.
So Louis B. Mayer took mythical WASP culture, shaped it, amplified it, and then fed it back to WASP America and to Jewish America and to Catholic America.
Yes.
Hello, folks. What'll it be?
I want a chocolate soda with vanilla ice cream, please.
Make it two, buddy.
You bet.
Yes, sir. There's something about a high-class ice cream soda that makes a fellow feel as though he's wasting time with meat and vegetables. Ain't it the truth?
Samuel Goldwyn had a version of that, which goes right back to the squalor he grew up with in Warsaw. And it has to do with the absolute cleanliness of every set in every Goldwyn movie. Even when he made a movie such as Dead End, and it, you know, it takes place in a slum in New York. And in fact, the director of that film told me, William Wyler, that when they were filming the movie, Goldwyn used to come on the set in the morning and start picking up the garbage that the set decorator had put there. And Wyler said to him, but Mr. Goldwyn, this is a slum, and slums have garbage. And Goldwyn said, not my slums.
The moguls were really the auteurs of their studios. I mean, yes, they had great directors and producers and stars, but the final word on what went into these films were the moguls.
I think the studios had personalities during the golden age of Hollywood, but the way that I think of it is that there was a system, and these moguls built these factories.
Here we go. Hit your lights.
And they were great industrialists.
Hit your wind.
They were captains of industry, but their industry was entertainment. And so, of course, they watched what came off the assembly line.
Hit your steam.
But I think that it was a collaborative art that's shaped, in a general sense, by the personalities of these producers.
Each of them puts out a certain kind of product, which in many ways reflects where their films were being shown. And so the Metro Company, Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, which was owned by Lowe's, basically they had the New York territory. And so MGM movies were a little more sophisticated, a little glossier than most of the movies. The Warner Brothers movies played a lot in the South, and they were a little more interested in grittier material. And so the Warner Brothers movies became famous by the late 20s into the 30s and the 40s for films that were sort of ripped from the front pages, gangster movies. Their musicals were not glossy. They did the Gold Digger, the Busby Berkeley musicals.
Come and meet those dancing feet on the avenue I'm taking you to.
I personally love Westerns, always did.
Adolf Zukor, from a 1958 oral history.
I think that Western is, well, that's the way of life. Biggest hit we made was with Covered Wagon. And not only was Covered Wagon a success in this country, but it was a success all over the world. Because that was America. That showed the development of America, the people going west, developing and struggled, suffered, worked. It was an epic. It's American history. That's America.
You've been listening to White Christmas, the story of the Jews who created Tin Pan Alley and Hollywood, Part 1. In the next program, called Over the Rainbow, we'll hear Part 2 of the story of the Jews who created Tin Pan Alley and Hollywood.
Al Jolson is, in a way, the model or the ego ideal for all the moguls. And the jazz singer was inspired by him. All these incredible scenes where his father, the cantor, wants him to come back, and he says, no, my songs mean as much to my audience as your prayers do to your congregation. That was something that the moguls certainly could identify with. They really recognized that this was their story.
We'll also look at Jewish performers, from John Garfield to the Marx Brothers, to Betty Boop. And we'll find out what happened when the House Un-American Activities Committee took on Hollywood. This program is part of the series Only in America, 350 Years of the American Jewish Experience. The series was developed, written, and executive produced by Larry Josephson for the Radio Foundation. This program was produced by Larry Josephson, Sarah Elzis, and Sarah Parath. It was edited by Sarah Elzis. Our script consultant is Paul Fisher. Marty Goldenson is our resident radio doctor. We had help from Sarah Kramer, Adam Goodkind, Franny Carr, Eleanor Ostrinsky, Rosa Goldenson, Maisie Tivnan, Raylan Grogan, and Diana Green. Our historical consultant is Dr. Jonathan Sarna. The interviews were recorded by Bill Sigmund and Robert Auld. Post-production by David Rapkin and Robert Auld. A very special thanks to Nikki Newman Tanner. Thanks also to Bob Gill, who designed our logo, to my assistant, Deborah Sithopoulos, and to Andy Lancet, who runs the WNYC archives. The excerpt from Operation Shylock by Philip Roth was read by the author. Oral histories of Adolf Zucker and David O. Selznick are courtesy of the Columbia University Oral History Office. To hear this program or others in the series, and for information about podcasts, CDs, and transcripts, visit our website, onlyinamerica.info. Send your comments to only@radioart.org or call our comment line 212-595-2920. Only in America is made possible with grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the National Endowment for the Arts, because a great nation deserves great art. Additional funds from Saul and Stanley Zabar in memory of their parents, Louis and Lillian Zabar, Russian immigrants who founded Zabar's more than 70 years ago. Zabar's, a New York landmark, supplies food and delicacies to New Yorkers and to the nation. On the web at zabars.com. Additional support from Edwin A. Goodman, Harvey and Thelma Reisman, the John L. Loeb Jr. Foundation, from Frost, Zelnick, Lehrman, and Zissou, specializing in intellectual property law for clients worldwide. On the web at frostzelnick.com. And from one anonymous donor. This is Larry Josephson.
This program is distributed by the WFMT Radio Network.